Good morning. My name's Julie McVeigh, and this morning I want to tell you a story about how this church came to be. Did you know that a long time ago, our neighborhood was not called West Roxbury? It was just called Roxbury. And I wanted to tell you also what happened here in what they used to call the westerly end of Roxbury in 1706. That's a really long time ago, don't you think? It's actually 312 years ago, a long time ago. The idea came to the people who lived in this area they said together, we should have a church here. Our roads are terrible. I'm going to show you a picture of the roads, and you can pass it around so you can see that the roads did not have pavement. It was just dirt. Here we go. It's just dirt. So when it rained or it snowed, the dirt turned into mud. So when they tried to go all the way to what was called the First Church in Roxbury, their wagons got stuck in the mud and they couldn't go to church. Well, they were church was very important in those days, and because it was so important, they said, you know, we could fix this problem of getting stuck in the mud by building a church here in the westerly end of Roxbury. I wanted to show you what the children in the westerly end of Roxbury might have looked like when they were dressing up. When the people couldn't go to their church, the First Church of Roxbury, they missed their friends. They missed all the news of the day, because that's where news got passed, was at church. And another big problem was that the government, it was called the General Court. And this is a picture of what the General Court would have looked like in 1706. So the General Court told them they had to go to church. That was a requirement. It was actually a law that you had to go to church. So the ancestors who had had the idea of building a church went to the General Court and said, we really need to have a church here in the westerly end of Roxbury. That happened in 1706, 312 years ago. The good news was the General Court said, sure, you can have a church, but you have to talk to the First Church of Roxbury to plan where that church should be. So that's what they did. And here's a picture of what it might have looked like in the church when they were talking to the First Church people. So they talked, and they talked, and they talked, and they talked for 5 years. They talked. And
After 5 years, the people who lived here in the westerly end of Roxbury said, let's just do it. And so they did. They just went ahead and built their church in the westerly end of Roxbury. This is a picture of what that church probably would have looked like. It didn't have a steeple, it didn't have a bell, but the people loved it. The General Court and the First Church of Roxbury, you might imagine, were not happy. As a matter of fact, they were very unhappy. And so for the next year, they talked. And they finally decided, well, here's this really nice building. And it did solve their problem of getting stuck in the mud, if you remember. Perhaps it's a good thing. So they decided after it was already done that it was okay. So in 1712, the General Court and the First Church of Roxbury helped the people in this neighborhood, our church ancestors, to start their church. They hired a minister and they began. As I was thinking about this story and how to tell it today, I was reminded of Amanda's being on the balance beam. Do you remember that from last week when Amanda did the balance beam? Well, I thought, you know, that our ancestors probably felt out of balance when they couldn't go to church, they couldn't see their friends, and they couldn't get the news that they needed. And so that's what they felt like, is this, oh my gosh, I've got to do something to get into balance. And so that's what it must have felt like to them. They decided to make a church so they could make a better life for themselves and their children. So 312 years after they built the Second Church of Roxbury, and shortly after that made the town of West Roxbury, here we are. And we have another church building, which you know looks like this. It's a lot different from the church that was built in 1711. And we have a different name. In 1711, we were named the Second Church of Roxbury. It's pretty logical. Since we were the second church to be built. Our church now, as we all know, is Theodore Parker Church. Our building isn't 312 years old, I'll tell you. It's only 118 years old. But just like the first people, we're very proud of our building and happy to be here. We, in our day, still need to get into balance. And that's our job as members of our church, is to help us get into and stay in balance.
This is an excerpt from the dedication service of this building on October 5th, 1900. So may this house be our altar, our school of noble ministries, our common home and fireside. Here let the glory of nature in her seasons be revered with thanksgiving. Here, let the things which make for civic righteousness and national honor be taught, the country's festivals be kept, her helpers and defenders be commemorated. Here, let all services that make home beautiful be fostered. Here, let the children love to come. Here, let our aged ones be greeted reverently. Here, week by week, let the strong consecrate their strength, and those who sit in shame renew their hope, and those who are beset be comforted. Here, let the babe be welcomed to the earth, the wedding vow be hallowed, the God be with thee uttered for our dead. Here, let our dead be tenderly remembered, and those who sorrow find the peace of God. Within these walls, let no one be a stranger, but all find home who come for ends of truth and righteousness and love. Perhaps some of you may have thought the title of this reflection alluded to yet another life mastery approach pitch delivered by a manic individual with a headset and available in multiple easy-to-pay-for segments. Thankfully, it is not. However, with this morning's theme of rebalancing, I would offer the question, what is it we are rebalancing, and when does this momentous event occur? To explore this from an engineer's perspective, that's the only one I have, consider Theodore Parker Church as a system. As a system, Theodore Parker can be defined as a bounded process, transforming inputs into outputs, where the inputs are both external and internal influences, and outputs are produced as actions of the church members. As a community, we are subject to external factors and internal ones via our members and friends. And our output is both tangible as support to the community and intangible in the advancement of our spiritual journeys. How this happens is a function of the system's characteristics. I consider two of the most significant characteristics at Theodore Parker Church, which has sustained us through the years, to be self-determination and a sense of stewardship. The start of this church in 1713 as the second church in West Roxbury occurred when the congregants self-determined that there should be a local church, decided to create one, and to ask for forgiveness later. Something that has put us in good stead over the years. And stewardship, in its most simple definition, is the job of taking care of something. The stewardship of Theodore Parker Church traces from its beginnings 300 years ago and extends to where we are today. I first started coming to the church in 1983. The better times Theodore Parker Church had seen were getting farther away by the minute. External inputs such as youth and resources were in short supply within an environment of conservative demographics. However, that church again, like those in the past, determined that the type of community they could and wanted to be could still exist, and responded to a sense of stewardship that a liberal spiritual entity should continue to exist in West Roxbury. We were unique and eclectic, but no one was going to be the first to leave and start an exodus leading to oblivion. There were those outside of the church who saw something worth supporting and that it should continue. Theodore Parker is a different church today than it was in 1983, just as the church at any point in its history is different from any other.
Because we determine what we will be on a continuous basis, not a periodic one. The priorities will vary from year to year, and I have no doubt the church will continue to change as a function of our external environment and our internal desires. But we ourselves have the responsibility both to determine what Theodore Parker will be today and to carry on so that there will be a Theodore Parker church in the future that can determine what it should be then.
In 2000, I gave the homily for the 100th anniversary of this building. Excerpting from what I said then, many of us have been touched by life within this church. The building is a container for our community. As we celebrate this building, we also celebrate what we become as it gathers us together within it. It also bears witness to our continuities and changes. May we allow ourselves to be touched and allow ourselves to be called to grow as individuals and as a community. These past few years, I have been touched, challenged, and inspired to grow by the longings, the strivings, the callings of many of you to social justice work, to spiritual work, and the complexities, and also by the complexities of ordinary life that are taken up through candles and conversations. I think we grow from the challenges that knock us out of balance, out of comfort, and they may arise from these quarters, the social justice work, the spiritual work, the ordinary life work, and also other quarters. For me, one of the challenges these past few years has been that I've begun to experience a sense of God again. It's full of wonder for me and also full of the ordinary, and yet it's a big challenge for me and for me in relationship to people here. Even the word spiritual can sometimes be difficult here, let alone God. So I keep learning what I mean by this language, because I want some fellow travelers in this learning. I dream of a time when the word God is not the conversation stopper, but the start of the conversation, when we begin to ask ourselves, what do we mean? What do we mean by that word, whether we have any experience of it or any belief in it or not? And the same for words like spiritual source, etc. Initially, I kept my experience to myself, given my projection that it wouldn't be welcomed. I'm afraid that may happen to other people about other sorts of experiences. I'm getting more comfortable and more comfortable welcoming the differences that I've always said I welcomed, but maybe didn't really because, well, it's really vulnerable. I don't want to be so vulnerable all the time. And I believe that the tenor of acceptance within this congregation has also changed, and it's changed also from the pulpit. I sense myself continuously rebalancing to keep up with my own changing self of sense, and a church that is rebalancing, in part because others are changing, and in part because of the challenging times we're in. I imagine that others here, for whatever reasons, find their own sense of self shifting at times and wonder how that aligns with this simultaneously shifting congregation. Moving on to what I see as a church-wide rebalancing over the last few years, well, each day has been a new upset, and occasionally there's a new hope. Living through this period in our country and our world has changed us as a congregation, and I believe it has strengthened us. I am grateful for what I see as a rebalancing of energies to meet what's been coming at us. We were already in this process prior to the presidential election. There was a lot of education happening here. The pipeline protests were in gear. There was a lot going on. And I'm grateful to the people who spoke up and educated us about the issues that were dearest and closest to their hearts. They dreamed us forward. After the election, we upped our commitment. In grief, in anger, in fear, in love, we met each other at rallies. We became a level 2 sanctuary. We completed the already begun process to hang the Black Lives Matter banner. And we intensified other efforts that were already begun. And, you know, to me, it's not only being on the balance beam or on the tightrope, it's like at the circus where they, you know, maybe throw a chair at the person who's on the tightrope or a bar or something and you have to keep going. I mean, that's kind of what it was like. We had to keep standing with that extra chair or bar coming at or whatever got tossed in our direction. And for some of us, upping the social justice work stimulated a need to strengthen the spiritual life of the church as well. Not that it was ever abandoned. We had small group ministry, we had meditation nights, our relationships with one another, and Reverend Ann's sermons, among others, grounding a social justice orientation in UU principles and a deep spiritual understanding. But to some of us, it still felt out of balance. Perhaps we come to church versus a political organizing group wanting to nurture our spiritual selves in the first place. Perhaps we see our social justice work as a spiritual practice itself, and we want to deepen that understanding. Perhaps we want the spiritual as a sustaining element for the long haul of what we're facing as a country and a world. Regardless, I feel that we have seen some of that rebalancing this year, and I, for one, appreciate it. And since this is Pledge Month, here's my statement. It's one of the number of reasons that I'm pledging this year. As I go through the shifts and rebalancing of various aspects of my own life, having this community to move with, I hope you're moving with me. I'd like to see some movement moving with me. Thank you. That's what I need to find my way to move through this mess and this wonder that is our lives.
So as everybody knows by now, we're in the middle of our annual pledge drive. This is our third Sunday, and it's our practice to have pledge testimonials every week of the pledge drive. So mine is going to be very brief on the theme of balance, and then a little bit of history of pledge drives at Theodore Parker Church. I do want to make one comment about what Katie Lee said about how balance should not be the goal. Balance is very much the goal of the pledge drive. We really need a balanced budget, folks. So keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. And before I say anything else, I just want to thank everybody who has pledged already. You are increasing your pledges this year, which is excellent. We have new first-time pledgers responding to our call. So good for you. And if you haven't turned in your pledge card yet, do it as soon as you can. And again, thanks for your generosity. This year is actually the 31st pledge drive in the modern era of Theodore Parker Church. When I started coming here in the early 80s, along with Doug and Carol and John Lambert and Cecilia and a few other people, we didn't have a pledge drive. We were relying on the very meager Sunday offering given by the approximately 15 people who came to church, mostly elderly and on fixed incomes. We dipped into our endowment, which we had to do, but was not good stewardship, obviously. We sold Christmas trees here back in the day. A few people will remember. John Lambert used to organize that. We collected returnable cans and bottles and returned them for the deposit. That didn't go very far either. We had some renters in the early days. We had a Head Start program here in our basement, and we had dancing classes here. That did bring in revenue, but it meant that we didn't have use of our own space, and it was very difficult to run our religious exploration programs with Head Start pretty much owning the building during the week and having their stuff around. So through increasingly successful pledge drives, we've been able to take our space back, which has been great, and it's resulted in the expansion of our youth children and youth programs and our adult programs as well. So in 1988, we started our first canvas and pledge drive. We did canvas visits. The congregation was small enough that we were able to visit everyone in the congregation and start to really collect feedback about what people were hoping for here, what their dreams were for the church that has built and built and built. This year we are doing more visits with some of our newer folks, and we're getting a good response from that. So I just once again wanted to remind everybody that it's your generosity that is allowing us to continue to grow and thrive in love and friendship and celebration of all we have here. Once again, thank you for your extreme generosity and participation in the pledge drive. Thank you.
So I can't tell you stories about the history because I'm a new member. Not so new, maybe 2.5 years or so, but new enough that this is the congregation I discovered when I came. And I just want to ask, do I have some compatriots out here? Anybody who joined within the last 5 years? Oh, yes. So you're going to get this. You're really going to get this, I think. Maybe you were braver than I was. I was afraid to come. And for several years before I dared to come, I had been, what I called at my house, worshiping at the Church of the Arboretum. My husband, who has a church, goes to church in Brookline, would leave every Sunday morning for church, and I'd walk out, and he'd say, "Where are you going today?" And I'd say, "Church of the Arboretum." And I'd go, and I'd walk and sit, sometimes pray, in the congregation of all beings. And it was really church for me. It really is a holy, meaningful space, and it still is. So lots of you know about the healing and holy powers of the natural world, but it isn't the same. You don't connect with the people. I connected more with the trees and the flowers than with the actual people. So I want to give you a little of my backstory, and I kind of hate just this being about me, but in order to get to my point, you have to know this. All of my early religious experiences were in the Catholic Church and Catholic schools. I'm sure I'm not alone there either. I started going to church in the early 50s when women and girls wore hats and gloves and the Mass was in Latin, and so were the hymns. And then in my high school years, everything turned around. Pope John the 23rd ushered in an exhilarating new time in the Catholic Church. The Mass was in English, girls could sing, and no head covering was required, plus much more helped to make it meaningful and inviting. And in those glory days, as a teenager, I was all in. And I felt a really strong call to ministry. But that was not going to happen. As you know, ministry was, and pretty much still is, a men-only kind of thing there. So I found a college, a secular college, and I found my soulmate later, and we were married in a Catholic chapel on the Dartmouth College campus. And we were fired up young adults. We felt like we were part of the church of what's happening now, and we were going to change things, and it was going to be great. How wrong we were. The typical suburban Catholic parish of the 1970s simply did not work for us. Instead, I found my soul nurture in nature. We lived in an 1830s farmhouse on 16 acres in Vermont. My congregation was the trees, the birds, the rivers, the ponds, the woods, and my own backyard. All these fed me spiritually. Until, wham, life as I knew it fell apart. Our marriage ended, and I was like, now what? Well, about that time, I'd stumbled into the Unitarian Universalist congregation in Norwich, Vermont. They worshiped together in the local elementary school, and I felt welcome there and held in the embrace of a community that cared about a lot of the same things that I cared about. And I began to heal in their loving presence and also dream of making a new life for myself. Sometime around that same time is when I heard the call again. It was clear and certain. I still wanted to be a minister. Well, having discovered Unitarian Universalism, I knew that a 40-plus-year-old woman like me was not only welcome in the pews, but also in the pulpit. Fast forward through divinity school, that's a quick romp over 4 or 5 years, I was ordained on my 50th birthday and served until my 70th. 15 of those years I spent as the minister at First Parish of Sudbury, where I'm honored to say I still hold the title Minister Emerita. So why, you would wonder, would a minister, a Unitarian Universalist minister, be afraid to walk into a Unitarian congregation and sit down in the pew? But I was afraid. I was afraid I'd criticize or judge the minister. Oh, I really didn't think that was a great sermon. I would never have done it that way. I thought I'd judge everything. And I was afraid I would not know how to be a parishioner. Well, I'm learning how to be a parishioner all over again. It's a curve, but I'm on the way. And I can say with my whole heart, this is my new home church. And you, everyone I see before me, and some whose faces I see in the pews who just don't happen to be here today, you helped make it so. And I thank you all for that. So if you are new or new-ish, I don't know how you feel, but I suspect you can relate to some of what I've said about how I felt. And I welcome you here with open arms. You see, when we say staying in balance means staying in motion, we who are new are part of the in motion part. So that's our collective job, and is to stay in balance by moving forward.